Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is Side 2, For the Record program number 742, titled Body Count, Sweet Home Alabama. This program is being recorded on May 15th of the year 2011. We're going to plunge right back in where we left off at the end of Side 1. We are going to take another article from the LegalSchnauzer.com website. Now, one of the people being investigated in connection with the Republican/Karl Rove machinations in Alabama, the machinations that appear to have precipitated this rash of highly suspicious deaths, was a fellow named Milton McGregor. And it is alleged in this post that a couple of FBI agents were harassing Milton McGregor, or not Milton McGregor, but people investigating Milton McGregor, were harassing Bob Cavanaugh, one of these alleged suicides. This is from April 4th of 2011. FBI harassment preceded Alabama official's suicide. Two FBI agents harassed an Alabama deputy attorney general before he committed suicide last November, all because the agents mistakenly thought the deputy attorney general was trying to help gambling magnate Milton McGregor. William Bob Cavanaugh died from an apparent self-inflicted gunshot wound on November 15th as FBI agents Keith Baker and John McEachran III were conducting an investigation, were conducting a harassment campaign against him, according to a report in the Montgomery Independent. Baker and McEachran were involved in an investigation of McGregor which led to the ongoing prosecution of 11 individuals connected to gambling-related measures in the Alabama legislature. We have reported on the Cavanaugh story as one of several mysterious Alabama deaths that seem connected roughly to the last year of Governor Bob Riley's administration. The most recent such death came just last week when Birmingham businessman Charles Bubba Major reportedly committed suicide in Mountain Brook. And there then is a review of some of the suspicious deaths. Skipping down, how did Bob Cavanaugh incur the wrath of the FBI? Bob Martin, editor and publisher of the Montgomery Independent, reports, the deputy AG, Robert William Bob Cavanaugh, was in the process of conducting a background check on an individual with the last name of McEachern who lived in the Auburn-Opelika area. It was a matter involving workers' comp fraud. The Independent was told by the AG's office that agents Becker and McEachern became suspicious when they found out through the state's computer database that someone in the Attorney General's office was conducting the search involving McEachern's name. They went ballistic, according to a source at the AG's office, and began harassing Bob and accusing him of trying to help McGregor. And that was the end of him. By the way, Don Siegelman was defeated for re-election by Bob Riley initially. The reports had Don Siegelman the winner in 2002. Then there were charges of tampering with election machines and so forth. So, again, when Mitch Connell went down, that's one of the things that loomed large in this particular concatenation. And basically, in turning back to Don Siegelman's Wikipedia entry, Representative Bob Riley defeated Siegelman's November 2002 re-election bid by the narrowest margin in Alabama history, approximately 3,000 votes. The result was controversial, as on the night of the election, Siegelman was initially declared the winner by the Associated Press. Later, a voting machine malfunction in a single county, Baldwin County, was claimed to have produced the votes needed to give Siegelman the election. When the malfunction was corrected, Riley emerged the winner. Democratic Party officials objected, stating that the recount had been performed by local Republican election officials after Democratic observers had left the site of the vote counting, thus rendering verification of the recount results impossible. The state's attorney general, Republican Bill Pryor, affirmed the recounted vote totals, securing Riley's election. So that's what looms in the background of these deaths. Now, note that a couple of FBI agents were allegedly harassing the late William H. Bob Cavanaugh before his suicide. A couple of FBI agents, at least two, apparently have taken a similar route. This from the TickleTheWire.com website. Full listing. This is from April 27th of this year, 2011. The FBI wasn't saying much last weekend about the suicide of an FBI agent who shot himself in the Portland, Maine area over the weekend of April 24th, according to sources. The agent was in his early 50s, one source said. FBI agent Greg Komkowicz, a spokesman for the Boston FBI division, which includes Maine, told TickleTheWire.com, the type of question you are inquiring about is not something the FBI would comment on, unquote. Last year, an FBI agent assigned to Quantico, Virginia, committed suicide. Yet another FBI suicide, or alleged suicide, this from yourhoustonnews.com. Body of former FBI agent found in Waller County. This from November 20th of 2010. It's by Joe Southern. The body of a missing former FBI agent from Harris County was found Thursday near her car in Waller County, just north of Rolling Hills. Patricia Durney, who had been reported missing the day before, was retired from the Federal Bureau of Investigation and working in the private sector. Her car was found Thursday morning in a clearing off Wiggins Road, which set off a multi-agency search for her. A law enforcement helicopter and airplane circled the area while law enforcement officers searched on the ground with the aid of dogs. Agents from the FBI, Texas Rangers, Texas Department of Public Safety, and Waller and Harris County Sheriff's Offices responded. Quote, "The investigation continues, however, the initial investigation does not reveal any evidence of foul play," unquote, the Waller County Sheriff's Office said in a news release. Her body has been taken to the Harris County Medical Examiner's Office. Unconfirmed published reports indicate Durney died of, you guessed it, a single gunshot wound to the head. So, are those mere suicides? What might they have been investigating that might have led to that? Who knows? Now, I'm going to read a news and supplemental post. By the way, those of you who only follow the broadcasts themselves are missing out on a lot of the For the Record experience or the SpitfireList.com experience. I also post several times a week, most weeks, in the Food for Thought section in the upper right-hand corner of the front page of the SpitfireList.com. There are posts arriving, well, sometimes once or twice, sometimes more than that per week. And then when I post a new Food for Thought, they begin feeding down the left-hand side of the front page. Then eventually they go into the News and Supplemental section. Click on the Categories section on the right-hand side of the front page, and that'll locate For the Record, Anti-Fascist Archives, and News and Supplemental. I hope, time permitting, sometime to do a program about Jared Lee Loeffner, the guy who allegedly shot Representative Giffords and fatally shot a judge and one of her aides and also some other people down in Arizona. We're going to be talking about something else that happened right about that same time. But again, some of the key questions in connection with Jared Lee Loeffner. This from the News and Supplemental post about Jared Lee Loeffner. And I hope to do a program about this. There are links in the post which will enable you to pursue this at greater length before I get a chance to do a program, assuming that I have a time to do that and a whole lot of other things. A whole lot of the you-know-what doesn't hit the fan. Some of the salient questions and considerations in the investigation of the shooting of Representative Giffords and the murder of other people, including one of her aides and a federal judge. Was there more than one person involved? And we're going to read an account that a second person was being sought by officials. Was the targeting of Giffords, who was Jewish, partially or wholly inspired by Loeffner's alleged contacts with anti-Semitic online information? And again, links will enable you to explore these at greater length. Much publicity has been afforded Arizona's immigration laws, which, despite much official condemnation, have inspired similar legislation in other states. Arizona neo-Nazi elements have garnered publicity enforcing the border with Mexico, and some of these elements are associated with Arizona politicians who helped to craft the immigration law. Was Loeffner inspired by racist or anti-immigrant philosophy? Internet chatter has predictably featured Loeffner, and again, there are indications that may have been the case. Internet chatter has predictably featured Loeffner's mind control. Discussion alleging that Loeffner may have been a victim of the mind control programs that were undertaken and realized by U.S. and other intelligence agencies. By the way, a lot of these things, I don't think there's any way of making an overt, objective determination, at least not from where I sit. However, there are questions, and again, the links will enable people to explore the possibilities. In that same context, it should be mentioned that various racist, Nazi, and white supremacist groups have been used as foot soldiers by elements of our national security establishment. And Loeffner's attorney of the moment had previously defended Unabomber Ted Kaczynski, who may well have been a victim of mind control himself. Some associates of Loeffner have suggested that he's faking mental illness in order to escape prosecution for his crimes. We should note that he has studied past American alleged assassins, including Oswald, James Earl Ray, and others, who were framed for their crimes. So it's possible that he is feigning mental illness in order to basically escape the death penalty. Some of the accounts of Loeffner's political ideological orientation have indicated sort of what might be termed an ideological pizza, featuring an amalgam of primarily right-wing views mixed in with what are viewed as primarily liberal political stances. And one of the more intriguing considerations concerning Loeffner involves his apparent interest in these Zeitgeist movies. Zeitgeist is a 9-1-1 Truth production and is one of several movies in the Zeitgeist series. Their production has been underwritten by a far right-wing slumlord and backer of George Bush. The Zeitgeist movie, the original Zeitgeist movie, got a lot of play among the so-called truthers, a lot of play on the Pacifica Network, naturally. It involves people like Anthony Hilder, who many investigators have suggested may have been involved in the assassinations of certainly Robert Kennedy, possibly John Kennedy, and had foreknowledge of the assassination of Martin Luther King as well. A fellow named Edward G. Griffin, an overt anti-Semite and believer in the alleged veracity of the protocols of the Elders of Zion, has been, he's one of the people that's prominently featured in the Zeitgeist films. He's the author of a book called The Creature from Jekyll Island, a former campaign aide to George Wallace. So Zeitgeist, a far, far right-wing movie, but with some... actually, the guy's name is not Edward G. Griffin, but G. Edward Griffin, a former John Birch Society officer. So the Zeitgeist movie, ostensibly an investigative film, but actually a far right-wing, I would say more or less overtly fascist movie once you move beyond the introduction, is one of the influences on, one of the alleged influences on Mr. Loeffner. And a lot of the debate about Loeffner was whether he was realizing the agenda of the Sarah Palin Tea Party branch of the GOP. And some people have said he was nuts. Some said he was reviewing, he was fulfilling that legacy. You don't have to be nuts to be motivated by a political agenda. And the situation vis-a-vis Jared Lee Loeffner, I would note that in addition to the two, Sarah Palin, who had crosshairs on Representative Giffords, she just said she was targeted for a defeat in the elections. Glenn Beck, the late, I call him Glenn Dreck, the late talk show, he's not dead at this point in time, but he has been dismissed from Fox News, probably, some have suggested, after having G. Edward Griffin on as a guest and having Griffin... Griffin, again, being an individual who believes in the protocols of the Elders of Zion, not even Fox News could handle that. But do note that Glenn Beck was basically saying, you're going to have to shoot them, meaning Democrats, in the head. That's pretty unequivocal. That, of course, is what happened to Representative Giffords. A story from the Christian Science Monitor, Gabrielle Giffords' case, second man sought in mass Arizona shooting. And the article reads in part, one man is in custody, and this is from January 9th of 2011. One man is in custody, and authorities are looking for another the day after a mass shooting at a Tucson, Arizona grocery store left six dead and 13 gravely injured, including the apparent target of the attack, U.S. Representative Gabrielle Giffords. With the local sheriff's office and the FBI investigating, suspicions that the suspected gunman, Jared Lee Loeffner, had an accomplice would complicate the thesis that the shooting was the work of a lone and mentally unbalanced young man lashing out at the government. The existence of a co-conspirator could point to a more calculated plot and perhaps shed more light on the motive for the attack. We are not convinced that the man in custody acted alone. There is some reason to believe he came to this location with another individual, and that individual is involved, unquote, said Clarence Dupnik, Pima County Sheriff, at a press conference Saturday. Well, who might that have been, pray tell? Now, I would note that Representative Giffords was shot in January, shortly before the new Republican-controlled House of Representatives was to convene. Of course, Representative Giffords was a member, is actually a member of the House of Representatives. And one of the things that's interesting about this is that the fact that a federal judge was assassinated at the same time. He did not survive. Representative Giffords did. Some people have suggested that the judge might actually have been the primary target. He apparently did have drug task force experience. response. That, again, as is the case with many of the investigative possibilities vis-a-vis Jared Lee Loeffner, is not something about which I can make an objective determination from where I sit. Certainly the possibility that the judge may have been the primary target is one to be considered in light of all of the mayhem that's taking place on the other side of the border. Now, that very same weekend, Representative Giffords and the judge and others were shot on a Saturday, late Sunday, or perhaps in the early morning of Monday, another death took place, and that did not receive nearly as much attention. This was the death by fire of a woman named Ashley Turton. Ashley Turton was married to Dan Turton. Dan Turton was the liaison officer of President Obama's administration to the now GOP-controlled House of Representatives. She also was working as a lobbyist for Rudy Giuliani's law firm, Bracewell & Giuliani, law firm that does a lot of work vis-a-vis energy companies. And the day or evening that she was killed in this, quote, accident, unquote, she had played a lead role in helping to expedite the merger of Progress and Duke Energy to form the world's the country's largest utility. I would also note that Progress Energy had a reputation as being one of the more forward-looking of the large utility companies, and the head of Progress was actually a believer in global warming and believed that utilities should work with the government and reformist elements in this regard in order to begin diminishing greenhouse gases. I also want to note that whereas previously lobbyists generally saw to it that money flowed to both parties from the deep pockets of various industries. And while that's still the case to an extent, one of the changes that Grover Norquist made when he moved into Washington, again behind the Bush 2 administration, Grover Norquist, the K-Straight magnate, has been pushing lobbyists to only contribute to the GOP and not to Democratic causes, with the largest utility in the country, the new Duke Progress merge utility, being headed up by someone who was not only sympathetic to global warming, but that merger having been expedited by the wife of President Obama's liaison to the House of Representatives, one can wonder to what extent it might have been deemed useful to have her out of the way to see to it that those few large corporations that might want to have backed Obama and might want to have worked to prevent global warming or to attenuate global warming, well, let's just say she may have been considered inconvenient. What is really quite, well, the death itself is very disturbing. She had three young kids. Certainly one would have to feel for the husband, but it's a very suspicious death. I'm going to read the circumstances surrounding the death, and then go back and ruminate it a little bit. The article from the Roll Call website, Turton Fire Caused by Low-Speed Crash, police say. It's by Rachel Blade, Jessica Brady, and Ann Palmer from January 10th of 2011. This is the same weekend that Representative Giffords was killed and was shot and the judge killed. Excerpting from this post, the car fire that led to the sudden death of Ashley Turton was caused by the impact after a low-speed crash, according to the Major Crash Investigation Unit of the Metropolitan Police Department. It's quite possible that the victim was maneuvering the car and came in contact with some kind of flammable chemical materials, unquote, D.C. fire spokesman Pete Pieringer said. Turton, 35, was the former chief of staff to Representative Rosa DeLauro, Democrat of Connecticut, and wife of White House liaison to the House of Representatives, Dan Turton. Police said there was a heavy fire in the garage at 4:45 a.m. that caused significant damage to the 2008 BMW X5, which was partially backed out into the driveway and looked singed. Fire damage could also be seen on a corner of the brick home Monday. When the fire was extinguished, firefighters discovered Turton's body inside the car. In the post, in the written description for this article, and it's already up in the news and supplemental post titled, While Everyone Was Paying Attention to the Latest Lone Nut, you can see the car and the garage, and it just, let's just say the official version of this does not make a lot of sense. How come she couldn't get out of the car before she was burned to death? Certainly, the car doesn't appear that badly damaged. The back part appears hardly damaged at all. How come Ashley Turton couldn't get out of the car? How come nobody heard anything? Certainly, unless there was an explosion, she would have been screaming. Or was she, had she been knocked out? Had she been drugged? Again, I don't know, but the official version doesn't sound good at all. It doesn't look good when you see the pictures. I wonder if a message was being sent. Again, this was the same weekend that Representative Giffords was shot and the judge killed. The GOP-dominated House of Representatives was about to take, was going to be commencing its activities in a couple of weeks. And I wonder to what extent this was a message. Her late husband was Obama's liaison to the House of Representatives. I wonder if this was a way of getting a message across. Also note that the official version doesn't make much sense. The authorities were pointing out that she lived in a bad, near a bad neighborhood. What would that have to do if she ran into some sort of flammable liquid? Again, it doesn't make a lot of sense. Two more articles quickly about the death of Ashley Turton. This is from a blog. The full URL will be in the description of the program. Friends remember D.C. lobbyist Ashley Turton killed in mysterious fire. Ashley Turton was found burning car in garage. The Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives is now assisting D.C. Fire and EMS and D.C. Police with an investigation of a deadly fire that killed a key Washington lobbyist. 37-year-old Ashley Turton was killed in a fire as she backed out of her garage early Monday morning. And they talk about who she was, about the Duke Progress Energy merger, which was affected by Bracewell Giuliani and in which Ashley Turton played a key role. This from the Toronto Star. It's by Travis Miller of January 10th. It reads, Merger mania in the utility industry continues with the granddaddy of them all, at least so far. Duke Energy and Progress Energy have announced their intent to merge in a deal that will create the largest utility in the United States and among the largest in the world with a $37 billion market capitalization, $65 billion enterprise value, and $20 billion in revenue. And again, that largest utility was going to be headed up by someone who thought it was a pretty good idea to combat global warming and who was perhaps unusual in as the CEO of a major utility in that he had a fairly good outlook on the environment. Of course, Ashley Turton won't be around anymore. She got her global warming, didn't she? One of the reasons why I find all these alleged suicides of FBI agents or former FBI agents, the ridiculous body count piling up in Karl Rove's Alabama, and why I also take a good look at the reports of the second suspect in the shooting of Representative Giffords and the killing of the judge and others, and why I take a look at the death of Ashley Turton and say, huh, what is going on here? It's because Americans have refused to face up to a very large, very significant, and very ugly fact, which is that political murder is an established way of life in the United States. It has been an established way of life in the United States for decades. The daddy of them all, of course, the assassination of President Kennedy. I've talked about that at great, great length. One of the assassinations, which was not the work of a lone nut any more than I suspect the shooting of Giffords and the killing of the judge was, and which is inextricably linked with the assassination of John Kennedy, the assassination of Martin Luther King, the shooting of George Wallace, the elimination of George Wallace from the 1972 campaign eliminated the possibility that George Wallace might have run it as an independent, threatening Richard Nixon's so-called Southern strategy, which relied on the Republicans carrying the racist vote in the South in order to counterbalance traditional Democratic electoral strength in the Northeast and industrial Midwest. Recently, a story came out about something of a breakthrough in the investigation into the assassination of Robert F. Kennedy. What I'm about to talk about, namely some apparent corroboration of the girl in the polka dot dress story that comes from a Saran who had been placed under hypnosis and hypnotically regressed to the night of the shooting. Well, this has now come out. There was a report, and veteran investigators or people who've read up on the assassination of Robert F. Kennedy are familiar with the story of the girl in the polka dot dress. After Robert Kennedy was shot, a girl, as they called him, a young woman in a polka dot dress, ran out of the Ambassador Hotel yelling that she had shot Kennedy. We shot him. We shot Kennedy. There have been a number of theories about who she was and what happened. Certainly the LAPD's special unit senator didn't show a lot of interest in who she was or what she had to say. But the fact of the matter is that investigators have continued to pursue the investigation into the assassination of President Kennedy and the probability, almost certainly, that Saran Saran was not only not the assassin, but that he was under mind control and that somebody else was actually firing the shots. Amazingly, the girl in the polka dot dress story has now become part of the log of what Saran has apparently remembered while being hypnotically regressed. This is an AP story from Yahoo News, April 28th of 2011. Convicted RFK assassin says girl manipulated him. It reads in part, convicted assassin Saran Saran was manipulated by a seductive girl in a mind control plot to shoot Senator Robert F. Kennedy, and his bullets did not kill the presidential candidate, lawyers for Saran said in new legal papers. The documents filed this week in federal court and obtained by the Associated Press detail extensive interviews with Saran during the past 3 years, some done while he was under hypnosis. The papers point to a mysterious girl in a polka dot dress as the controller who led Saran to fire a gun in the pantry of the Ambassador Hotel. But the documents suggest a second person shot and killed Kennedy while using Saran as a diversion. For the first time, Saran said under hypnosis that on a cue from the girl, he went into, quote, range mode, unquote, believing he was firing at a target range and seeing circles with targets in front of his eyes. I thought I was at the range more than I was actually shooting at any person, let alone Bobby Kennedy, unquote. Saran was quoted as saying during interviews with Daniel Brown, a Harvard University professor and expert in trauma memory and hypnosis. He interviewed Saran for 60 hours with and without hypnosis, according to the legal brief. Sandy Gibbons, a spokeswoman for the Los Angeles County District Attorney, said prosecutors were unaware of the legal filing and could not comment. The story of the girl has been a lingering theme in accounts of the events just after midnight on June 5, 1968, when Kennedy was gunned down in the hotel pantry after claiming victory in the California Democratic presidential primary. Witnesses talk of seeing such a female running from the hotel shouting, "We shot Kennedy," unquote. But she was never identified, and amid the chaos of the scene, descriptions were conflicting. Throughout the years, Saran has claimed no memory of shooting Kennedy and said in the recent interviews that his presence at the hotel was an accident, not a planned destination. Under hypnosis, he remembered meeting the girl that night and becoming smitten with her. He said she led him into the pantry. "I'm trying to figure out how to hit on her. That's all I can think about," he says in one interview cited in the documents. "I was fascinated with her looks. She never said much, and she was very erotic. I was consumed by her. She was a seductress with an unspoken availability." Saran maintained in the hypnotic interviews that the mystery girl touched him or pinched him on the shoulder just before he fired, then spun him around to see people coming through the pantry door. "Then I was on the target range, a flashback to the shooting range. I didn't know that I had a gun," Saran said. Under what Brown called the condition of hypnotic free recall, he said Saran remembered seeing the flash of a second gun at the time of the assassination. Without hypnosis, he said, Saran could not remember that shot. Well, quite a bit of this has been known to investigators for some time. It's amazing to see this coming out now and in the mainstream press, and remains to be seen what comes of this. However, the fact of the matter is that when you see the sorts of things we've been talking about in this program, you want to be sniffing the air, and you want to be taking care not to take things necessarily at face value. That concludes Side 2 of For the Record program number 742, Body Count, subtitled Sweet Home Alabama. This program is being recorded on May 15th of the year 2011. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.